Here's Clint, I'm an alcoholic. And I'm glad to be here. I'm very glad to be here. My friend Gary came up from Southern California with me today, and I'm looking forward to a wonderful weekend with you. I need a little information about where you guys are. How, just in terms of length, is everybody here a member of AA? Any that are not, any Al-Anons? Everybody's AA. How many people here have more than 25 years of sobriety? How many have more than 20? 20, 15 to 20? 10 to 15 in there? How about 5 to 10? And 4? How many got 4? 3? 2? 1? Anybody with less than 1? Okay, welcome. Anybody with just brand new, 30 days, under 30 days? Is there anybody that's got a birthday, an AA birthday this weekend? Yesterday, an AA birthday over there and one back here. Three birthdays.
Make it down tonight.
Sir?
Some of you may remember the fellow that came here last year.
Okay, we got three birthdays, and if that guy comes in for his first year from last year, that'll be great. We'll have basically the schedule has already been laid out for you. Tonight, we're going to have two sessions, and I like 45-minute sessions with a 15-minute break. And if you can, we don't have any kind of, where we got a clock? Oh, up there on the wall, yeah. Okay, it's a little bit after, it's about, I show 8:05 right now. Is that what that thing says? I can't read it. And the first session, I'd like to just let you know who I am and why I would even presume so much to come up here and talk about this program, this remarkable program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I would like to do this weekend on the 12 steps, and I would, as advertised, and I would like to do it from the point of view of step 11. I would like to begin there tonight, talk about that, talk about where we want to be when we're through the process of the steps, how we want to be getting through a day and living our lives. I used to start it from the just at step 1 and 2, and on Friday night everybody went to bed ready to shoot themselves over the issues of powerless and unmanageable, and we had a little trouble getting them back, so we're starting at a different place for a lot of good reasons, which I think you'll see as we go along, because it just gives us a framework and a springboard to work. I know some of the guys that you've had here in the past, and you've had some of the people that have taught me what I know about these steps, some remarkable, remarkable human beings, and so I'm sure that you have enjoyed these sessions in the past, and it's my idea that none of us is here by accident, that we're all supposed to be together here this weekend, and I'm going to have some fun, and I hope you do too. There is, I would like to ask one more question. Has just about everybody in the room gone through the steps from the point of view as they're laid out in the big book? Is that something that's been your experience? Who has done that with some detail and just punched on through that way? Yeah. Okay, good. Well, this is a refresher for most of you. If you have not done that, the point of this weekend is not to go back and say, well, I did the, I took the steps this weekend. That will not be where you'll be at on Sunday at noon. Anybody that's done it and done it thoroughly knows it takes a lot longer than a weekend to do that. You may want to get some inventory out of the way on Saturday afternoon, or you may just want to play and take it easy. I think the 45-minute sessions and the 15-minute breaks are important because a lot of information, a lot of new ideas possibly for people, and some particularly, we just get a little bit assaulted with information and ideas, and there's never enough time to give all of the steps some real justice. I mean, you could do a weekend on one step and then another weekend on another step. But we're just here to give it an overview. I'm a product of the Southern California sobriety. What do we got going on? Oh, we got people coming in. Welcome, gentlemen. I'm a product of Southern California sobriety. I got sober there, thanks. I got sober there in 1966. I was living in Glendale. I was walking along the street, and in July of that year, a guy pulled up to the curb and called my name. I recognized him. He was my bail bondsman. And he said, come here. And I went over there. I thought there was another warrant or something out. He said, no, I'm going to take you someplace today. I'm going to take you someplace. And I didn't ask him where he was going to take me. My life was just hideous at that time. I was living in a shed with three other guys. I called it a garage for many years, and a couple of years ago, my wife said, we were over in Glendale, she said, I want to see that garage you lived in. And I said, well, it's right, and we got down there, she said, is that it? And I said, that's it. She said, that's not a garage. That's a shed, is what that is. And I looked, and by God, no car had ever gotten in that thing. It was just a shed with four rooms. I had one of those little rooms, and there was a shower out someplace. I could hear it sometimes. I didn't visit personally, but my little 8x10 room had a sticky linoleum floor, and my sole remaining possession was a clock radio, and I had a little box with some sheets in it, as I recall. And that room smelled bad, and it was a hot summer, and that clock radio was more trouble than it was worth, because it would start playing in the middle of the night. I just, damn thing, it just start kind of doing some music. I thought it might be hooked to Del Rio, Texas or something. This music just kind of, even after you pull the plug out of the wall, that radio would play pretty good for quite a while. And I knew that wasn't right, but I didn't know what to do about that. I had, and so when that guy asked me when he told me he was going to take me someplace, I figured this could be anything. This could go back to jail. This could go to county hospital. This might go out to the Laughing Academy at Camarillo. Remember that we had that out there in those days. And they didn't have any treatment centers or charm schools down there in those days. They had one place out in the valley. A couple of guys from the valley here, Ron Shire ran a treatment center. He called it Shire's Dryer. And it was a little spin dry operation. You'd be in and out of there in a couple of days. And that was it. And I thought, maybe out there, I don't know where. I knew I was nuts. I had no problem with that part of it, in the sense of my life was just a shambles. I woke up in that little room under the cot one morning, and I'm looking over in the corner, and I see that rat, the big rat over there, laying over there looking at me, and I'm looking at the rat, and he and I are, I'm afraid of him. I just know if I push him, he's going to charge me, you know. And figure he's going to win. I kind of kept my eye on him for a while, and then I'd black out or pass out, and first light of day came and an hour later, and I look again at that rat, and that rat had somehow turned into a pair of socks laying over there in the corner, and I had been held hostage by a pair of socks all night, and so I was in bad shape, and I knew I was in bad shape. There were warrants out, and I have three sons, and I hadn't seen them in years, nor I had two wives, two different marriages for those three boys, and I hadn't seen those women or heard from them or sent them any money or anything like that. I was just about, it seemed like Skid Row was maybe 3 weeks away. And so when this guy said, I'm going to take you someplace today, I had no idea where he was going to take me, and it didn't matter a hell of a lot. It just did not matter. And he put me in his car about noon and drove me across Glendale and into a little parking lot behind a laundry, and we went up a long flight of metal steps hung on the side of that building and into a big room, not this big, half this size, and there was a sign that said, Alano Club of Glendale, whatever that might be. And I sat down there with those guys. And nothing has been the same since that time. Nothing has been the same. But I didn't stay sober since that time. I was around for 3 weeks going to your meetings and having a sense of liking what I saw, really thinking perhaps what was wrong with you was similar to what was wrong with me. But I didn't think your answer would work for me. I don't know why, I just didn't think that. I found some pills after 3 weeks, some Dexamil. They had a product that they mixed Dexedrine and Miltown. And I liked that a lot. And I had discovered a stash of it, and I started taking that stuff. And I was drunk in a day. I was drunk. And I stayed bad drunk for 2 weeks. Bad drunk. Ran out of money, and the 14th of August, I woke up in that little smelly room, and I didn't have any place to go, and I walked, about mid-morning, I walked over to the club, the Alano Club. And I walked up that long flight of stairs, and there was a guy that had the door open and coffee on, a guy doing his job in AA. Thank God he was doing his job in AA. And he recognized me from the meeting. He said, how you doing? I said, I'm not doing so good. He said, what happened? I said, I got drunk and let everybody down. Oh, he said, are you alcoholic? And I said, I think he knew, but he wondered if I knew. Mustering up all the honesty I could, I said, yeah, I've been an alcoholic about a month now, something like that. He let that go. He didn't say anything to me about that. He let it go. But he did say this. He said, well, if you're alcoholic, you say you're alcoholic and you drank? And I said, yeah. He said, well, you didn't let us down. Alcoholics drink. It's not that you let us down. You may feel real bad about it, but you didn't let us down. He said, you didn't even surprise us. In fact, he said, if you want to surprise us, get a job. That'll surprise us. He's very kind to me, this man. He was incredibly kind to me, but he didn't come off of what he wanted to say. And what he wanted to say is that if I was alcoholic, I was always going to drink. What he wanted to say was, you'll drink. If you're alcoholic, you're going to drink. He could have said, if you're alcoholic, you ought to think about quitting. He could have said, if you're alcoholic, you ought to cut down. He could have said a lot of things. He said, you're going to drink. He even kind of nailed it a little bit more harshly than that. He said, you're going to drink no matter what. People tell you, don't drink no matter what. You'll drink. You'll drink. I heard it much later from a guy named Joe. You'll drink no matter what. You'll drink. And I knew I would. I knew that was the deal. I had no doubt about it. It didn't warm me up any. And he wouldn't talk to me about tomorrow. He wouldn't talk to me about anything but about staying there that day. About staying there in that goofy little Alano Club of Glendale that day. They had a kitchen. He said, if you get hungry and you need and you can keep something down, we'll fix you. Said, you can have coffee here. You're not subject to arrest here. You're safe here. But you got to stay here. There's a meeting at noon. There's a meeting tonight. Stay here. And that's all he would tell me. He didn't tell me that I would learn how to quit here. He didn't tell me that it was possible for me to quit. In fact, he said just the opposite. I stayed that day. It was the 14th of August, 1966. It was my last day I drank. I didn't drink from that day on. It was 33 years ago. Last month, on the 13th, I caught up with that bail bondsman in Hawaii at his home over there and reminded him who I was and thanked him for bringing me to that club. We had a sweet talk. I called him my first year. I said, "Don, it's Clint Hodges." And he was like, "Yeah, where are you?" He thought we were going to do some more business, you know. And the thing I noticed early in AA is that when they asked me where I was, I knew and I could tell them. That's one of the gifts of this thing, you know. We come to know our full name and address. A lot of us do. Not everybody, but a lot of us do. And that was something that I knew within a year of sobriety. I know today that I'd never quit. It seems so weird to say that. I never quit. I haven't had a drink in over 33 years. I didn't quit. And I don't know anybody in AA that's a real alcoholic, an alcoholic of my type, that quit. We don't seem to be able to do that. There comes a day beyond which we don't drink anymore. But I remember Chuck used to say, a guy down in Southern California years ago, Chuck Chamberlain, he died sober. He'd say, if I'd have known that was going to be my last drink, I would have had two. Yeah. Hey, quit and I'll settle. We don't quit. That obsession is removed. It's just taken from us, and we don't even, you'd think I would know exactly that moment that obsession was taken, and I didn't know for 9 months that I was on a different footing. There was new soil under my feet. I didn't know for 9 months that I hadn't quit. It took a while to get that. I mean, it's like, if it was, and you've never asked me to quit, I've never, it's not what's going on here. If it was about quitting, we'd start any step study weekend with something called step one, quit. Yeah. Quit, that's the first thing you got to do, you got to quit. And it doesn't say that. It's basically, step one says, you got to get that you are toast, is what it says. Powerless and unmanageable. Oh, great. But that's what it says. It's like, we're really lost. We're really lost. And we get a glimpse of it, but we know a drink will fix it. And it doesn't fix anything. And after a while, we even know that. And that was my experience. I had my first drink when I was 16 at a party after a football game. And when the party was over, I was 29 and living in the shed in Glendale. And that party was over, man. It had been over for a while. I'm 62 now. I've spent more than half my life here in AA with you. And I never signed on for 33 years of this. Never, ever, ever. And I don't have any business telling anybody about anything about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I will tell you this. I was asked along the way if I had taken these steps. And I said, sure. Yeah. And then somebody said, have you taken an inventory? And I said, oh, no, I haven't done that. Well, you ought to do that. And so at about 2.5 years of sobriety, maybe 2 years in there someplace, I wrote out an autobiographical inventory. Just told my life story on paper. And I met with some guys over a weekend and I read that. paper to another human being. And I had begun to pay some money back. I went to dental school over here in Portland. And my roommate there and I both got kicked out at the end of the second year of a four-year program. His because he was just screwing around, mine because I was drinking. But along the way, and to show him how good a roommate I was, I burned his couch down one night, falling asleep on it with a cigarette. And one of the things I did in those first two or three years of sobriety was write him a letter and send him a check and say, I'm sober in AA, and I'm really sorry about the couch, and here's a check. And he wrote me back the sweetest letter, and he said, that's so great. He said, he said, I'm sending you the check back. I'm so glad you're sober in AA. Donate the money to AA. And maybe someday I will. Maybe. Carl, my brother, had co-signed a note for me when I was in dental school. And I let him pay that thing. And he was a little hot about it. And he was not to get to AA for 17 years. But one of the things he knew about AA, the first thing he knew about AA after I got sober was, you get your money back. I sent him the money. I sent him like $50 a month for quite a while. And then I made some assumptions. One assumption was that I was living a spiritual life because I wasn't drinking anymore. And the book says what we have is a daily reprieve contingent upon our maintenance of our spiritual condition. Well, I'm not drinking. I must be maintaining my, you know, and then I'd move on. But basically, I'm a power seeker. And I have known since I was 5 years old that I don't have enough power. I'm not big enough for this life. I just am not big enough for this life. I don't have what it takes to do the deal. I knew it at five. People say, you're a big boy now, you do this. Yeah. But I knew two other things. I knew I can't tell anybody I'm big enough. I'm not big enough. And I also knew that I got to figure out a way to be big enough. To be big enough. And so maybe the money in my grandma's missionary jar, if I can steal that, maybe that'll be the deal. Maybe the candy I can steal at the store, maybe that's big enough. Maybe the lie and me are enough. And 16 years old, got it, me and the booze, that's big enough. Now I'm big enough. Now I'm big enough. I'm a power seeker. I want power. And most of us are like that. Most everybody in the room is a power seeker. Lack of power would not be a dilemma if we didn't really dig power. There's people here in Oregon, that... what? Okay. That don't care anything about power. There are people like that. There, none of them in this room, but there are people like that. We want power, and we sense it when we don't have the power, and we begin to scramble, and we don't tell anybody we don't have. We just want to begin to get something cooking, and sometimes we substitute stubbornness for strength, but it's still better than going it alone. You know, I mean, there's 100 ways to do that deal, but sober and drunk, and and nothing changed about that when I got into Alcoholics Anonymous. Nothing changed about that. I didn't have any power. Don, we were talking earlier tonight to Don P., who has been up here and who is a remarkably wonderful source of spiritual strength for me, says that when that the removal of that obsession is a gift. It's an absolute gift. And we have the rest of our lives to become comfortable with that gift. And it is a gift. I don't know what would I have done on the night of the 13th, 14th of August, to merit 33 years of sobriety. I was in huge trouble and drunk and nasty. And what did any of us do the night before we got sober to merit the gift, whether we've had the gift for 9 months or 12 years or 22 years or 33? We didn't do anything, except perhaps we prayed. And some of us remember our prayers and some of us do not. I don't remember mine. When I was... So all during that time, I was 5 years sober, somebody said, go to law school. When I was 9 years sober, the state of California gave me a license to practice law, which is pretty colorful because they wouldn't give me a license to drive a car when I got here, you know, so we're kind of moving up. But it was about power, you know. I thought that was going to be, it isn't a source of power, so it's just something interesting to do between meetings, but there's not a lot of power for a different set of people to report to. It's better answering ready for the defendant than being the defendant. But, and I played both of those games. When I was 17 years sober, I was in full flight from reality. I was banking on an image. I had the right home and the right car and the right... girl, started to say relationship. It was not that. It didn't have any of that dignity to it. But there she was, gorgeous. I had the right address. I had the right income stream. I was trying big cases. I had my name in the paper in L.A. Did that. And it didn't seem to be quite what I wanted. I started taking seminars. Est was a big one in those days. I'm on the search for something, right? I really want something. You get a guy like me with 17, 18 years of sobriety, and I'm on top of the airport Hyatt at LAX in Los Angeles doing a fire walk with some guy named Tony. trying to look cool. Go, God damn, that's hot. But I'm looking for power. You know, I want there's got to be a secret here, and I want to get that secret. They will promise you these seminars. Basically, the promise, and Paul Martin pointed this out to me. He's in Chicago, got 53 years of sobriety this year. He says, if I have any message, it's a message of one beggar talking to another beggar about where the bread is. I hear that, boy, I hear that. But he said, the promise of those things is that if you do what we tell you to do, and it'll take another $5,000 workshop before we can fully explain it to you. But if you'll do what we tell you to do, you can have your own way. That's the promise. And some of the information is great. Sometimes you even get your own way. Always a troubling thing for an alcoholic. And I tried that. And I'm right in the middle of AA. I haven't left AA. I'm still sponsoring people. I'm doing all of that stuff. And I'm 20 years sober. And I'm 21 years sober. And I'm 22. And I'm working harder and working faster and doing all of the thing. And 10 years ago, it got flat enough for me that I decided that I better take the steps. I acted like I'd take them again as if I'd taken them. I hadn't taken them. And so I started... I said the third step prayer. It's kind of like, you might wonder why I didn't start at step one. Well, I don't know. I guess I was going to buy in like a multi-level marketing thing. I'll be a supervisor or something. I don't know. I said the third step prayer. I didn't even take the third step. I just said that prayer. That's a very powerful prayer. And it's going to be something that I'll talk about a little bit this week, and it is extraordinarily powerful, this prayer. And within 100 days after that prayer, my life fell apart. About 100 days, the house was gone, she was gone. She came to me and said, I don't want to do this with you anymore. And we've been together 5 years living in this house. This house that was just, I always felt like the real owner was going to come home one day and tell me to get out. You know, it was like that. Beautiful place. And there should have been on the back of the front door, checkout time is. And I had to earn a lot of money every month just to wake up there. It was gone. And I'm living in a little apartment. My law partner came to me during that same 110 days, said, I don't want to do this with you anymore. And the income stream was gone. My image was gone. The thing I worked so hard to develop over the years was gone. I lost my identity 10 years ago. Now, before I forget to say this, the law practice got reestablished and all that stuff is, but from a different place. It shocks you when you're 53 years old and you've been sober 23 years and you think you're dying, and you are dying, and you think you've lost everything and are left with nothing. And God, how did that happen? And I went, I was scheduled to do some speaking, and I wound up back in some roundup, Music City roundup, ran into some guys from other parts of the country and sat up with them late at night in a hotel room. A guy named Don Pritz, I don't know who he is. A guy named Joe, I don't know who he is. A guy named Gary, whoever that may be. People from Louisiana. People from around the country. And I was one of the speakers, and a couple of them were speaking there that weekend, and we sat up late, and I got that they were doing something that I was not doing and had never done and really didn't even know about. One of these guys was then living in Denver, but he told me that he was moving out to the West Coast and that he would call me when he got in town and maybe we could get together. And by the following January, 91, I guess, he and I were sitting down regularly going through this book. And it started me on the most amazing leg of the trip, the most incredible thing that I have ever been through. And it's that I want to talk about this weekend. Those steps from that point of view right out of this book, where we made some wild assumptions that everything in that book is true. We just assumed that. Everything in that book is applicable to me at 23 or 24 years of sobriety or 33 years of sobriety. It isn't for the guy just getting sober. Everything in that book has, every sentence is a gold mine. It's inspired. I think Wilson just held the pen. I think it came through him. He couldn't have written that at 3 or 4 years of sobriety. No way. No way. And they said, you're like a guy, all of this time in sobriety, you're like a guy that wanted a cake, a chocolate cake. And you went out and bought a box of cake mix. And you read the directions on the side. And you said, where's the cake? Come on, come on, come on, I want the cake. I got to get on with it. I don't have a lot of time. Screw around. Give me the cake. There's no cake. So if you're like me, what you do is you go to a meeting where other guys are reading the cake. And if all they're doing is reading the directions on the side, you're not going to get any cake. You get a bunch of guys, you can speak them in French. No cake. Sing them. No cake. It's just directions on the side of a box of cake mix. And the more faithfully you follow the direction when you finally decide to do something, the better the cake. The better the cake. They said, you're the lab rat. We don't know if those guys were telling the truth or not. That might be the biggest hoax in the city, this big book. What is that? You get a guy like Wilson writes a book, he uses phraseology like the goose hung high. What the hell is that, Bill? Stop it! and they say it's got some value to it, and they tell us what to do in the book, we'll never know, will we? Unless we do exactly what they said they did. And if we get what they claim they got, then we'll have something. At least we'll know it's a hoax if it's a hoax. And we can go back to the firewalk on top of the airport high. Don told me, I'm walking down this trail, and if the sign says there's a two-headed calf 1 mile down that way, I'm going. I got to go look at the two-headed calf, and if there's a crippled monkey making love to it, I'll stay a week. And I said, I'm like that too, man. I look under every rock. He said, yeah, that's great. Look under this rock. Well, these are only suggested steps. Yeah, it doesn't suggest anything else, though. That's what it suggests. Work with us here. I'm going, okay. A year went by, and I'll shut up here in a minute. We'll take a break, but I'll tell you this. A year went by. I call him up. I don't know, still don't know what happened, why it all hit the fan the way that it did. I said, Don, I still don't get this thing about I lost everything in 3 months. In fact, I was just looking, looked like 100 days, and it's just gone. Gone, everything I'd worked for. He said, well, what were you doing at the beginning of that 3 month period? I said, well, I was just doing my deal. I was, I remember I was, AA had gotten so flat, I thought I ought to take the step, so I said the third step prayer. He said, really? You did that? Did you take step one? No. How about step two? No. You took the third step. Did you notice that just under that third step prayer, it says we thought well before taking this step, making sure we could at last abandon ourselves? I said, I didn't notice that. He said, well, did you at least notice that in the middle of the step it says, relieve me of the bondage of self? I noticed that. He said, well, what were you bonded to? I said, oh, my God, I was bonded to my image. And what comprised your image? Well, a girl, the house, the car, the address, the income stream, the law practice. He said he relieved you of that bondage. Took him about 100 days to do it. Next question. And so it's amazing how when we begin this process, it sets into motion spiritual laws that we only dimly perceive. It is such power. It's what we've been looking for. Not our little ragtag power. Not my power, but power. Power. And so we'll talk about step 11 when we come back. Let's take a little break. Come in the middle of a meeting that really... Leave that tape off for just a little bit, will you? There is... Frank reminds me to tell you that there's paper and pencils over there. If you want to... grab any to make notes or whatever you want to do. We have a couple of diners in the back there. I guess they're going to join us when they get done, I hope. You know what? It's like we really didn't know the difference between everything and nothing when we got here. We thought we'd lost everything when we had to go to AA, and we're left with nothing, and the nothing that we were left with turned out to be everything. And the everything we thought we lost turned out to be nothing. And that was my experience. In 1990, I had lost everything from my point of view and was left with nothing. And that wasn't what it turned out to be at all. I have... typically, when we talk about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, just to give some perspective on it, we talk about a triangle. It's an equilateral triangle, and it has unity, and it has service, and it has recovery. Unity is the touchstone of unity is this idea that we're joined together in brotherly love. He talks about the feeling amongst the passengers of an ocean-going liner moments after rescue from shipwreck. There's a sweetness and a closeness there. Wilson's language is very precise. He writes tight. He just gets it said in very few words. But listen to that moments after, not a week later when the resentments have come back, but moments after rescue from shipwreck. That's a closeness and a sweetness that we enjoy here that will be part of our experience together this weekend. And it's comprised of two things, as you know. Common problem and a common solution. Both necessary. When I was in jail, everybody in that drunk tank had a common problem, had the same problem. But we didn't have a common solution. And I didn't get any sense of camaraderie. You know, you don't really say, would you be my sponsor to some guy in the drunk tank? You know, or how about, hey, let's meet a year from today. We'll meet right here. You know, it's not that kind of thing. And I've been in church, and perhaps you have too, and they offer a common solution. But it didn't warm me up. I was brought up in the Church of the Air in Billings, Montana, and there was some strange stuff going on there from my point of view. I went down to the front of the church one day to see what was going on. My uncle was down there getting saved, and they sent him to China to be a missionary. I stayed away from the front of that church for the rest of my time there, I'll tell you that. I got baptized in the Yellowstone River early one March. I didn't find God, I'll tell you that. I didn't find much anything for about 3 days, as I recall. Wow. There wasn't a common problem there. They were offering everybody a common solution. You've got to believe this, you've got to believe this. But here, we're so fortunate. Common problem, common solution. We have 12 traditions that really remarkably tell us how to treat one another. If the steps ask us to make a decision or take an action, the traditions ask us to do something else. They ask us to give up something. Each one of them. In order to be with each other, we have to give up something. In order to be in a good marriage, we have to give up something. I never thought that was going to be necessary for me. I never thought it would. But look at that language on page 564. Our common welfare should come first. What do I have to give up? Having my welfare come first. Number two, for our group purpose, there's but one ultimate authority. What do I have to give up? Being the ultimate authority. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is what do I have to give up? Telling other people whether they can be a member or not. And each one of them is like that. We're not going to talk much about the traditions, except I would like to share with you a letter that was given to me. A copy of it was given to me. This is a letter that was written, if I have it here. I don't have it here. I'll bring it tomorrow. But we were all in the early 40s. We were telling people that you can't stay here. You can't be a member of AA. We just don't like you and you got to go. And there was a letter written by the important people in AA in Los Angeles in 1941, wrote a letter like that. It annoyed them. And that letter somehow was saved in an archive, and somebody gave me a copy of it. I'll read it to you tomorrow. It's amazing. And we forget how important these traditions are. And so that's one leg of the triangle. Over here is the service piece. The service really is, unity is about getting my body to the meeting, about meeting in a body, about being part of one another. The service is about my spirit. My spirit. Anytime I'm involved in service, that is, doing something for somebody else with no price tag on it, it enhances my spiritual life. Whether I'm setting up chairs or going on a 12-step call or taking a panel into one of the prisons or doing something in a service, free and for fun, for nothing. And it enhances my spiritual life and enlarges me in that way. And we have this 12 service concepts. And that govern that. And then the base of the triangle, this equilateral triangle, is recovery. Recovery is about the 12 steps. Recovery has to do with my mind. My mind is the problem. There is a process that we can go through if we take these 12 steps that will give us a new mind. Silkworth called it an entire psychic change. New mind. And that new mind comes up at about step 7. We don't get that we have a new mind for a while. But it's a completely different way of looking at things. A new pair of glasses. And this is kind of... there has an antiquity to this. St. Paul said, be ye transformed by the renewal of your mind. We need a new mind. We need a new mind. All kinds of treatment on the mind that I brought in here doesn't seem to get the job done. I can't sprinkle enough Prozac on that puppy to really matter much, you know. I need a new mind. And that's what this is about. Recovery is about that. The steps are about the mind. So we have body, mind, and spirit. And for the first 23 years of my sobriety, I did not have an equilateral triangle. I was engaged in AA, and I was in a group where service is all over the place. And I was in a group where unity was clearly part of it. But I didn't have any recovery. I didn't get engaged in the steps. I was not signed on to the solution that's offered here. And so my triangle had to look like a little narrow guy with a little narrow base, which is very unstable. It's not an equilateral triangle. Just an unstable little triangle. That's basically what that looked like. A lot of unit. And you know what? People say, how the hell did you stay sober? Well, you know what? There's a great line in the eighth chapter of the book. It says, God has either solved your drink problem or he has not. I mean, anybody that's been here any length of time will join me when I say, sometime along the line, if it had been up to me in 33 years, if I had a choice, I've been angry enough to drink. I've been scared enough to drink. I've been humiliated enough to drink. I've been jealous enough to drink. I've been terrified enough to drink. If it'd been up to me, I drink. That's what I do. And I think it's important that we begin to get the idea that we didn't quit. We really didn't quit. And we're not... I think there's kind of a sober insanity that says I can keep myself sober and I can get other people sober. And we have to watch that creeping in, I think. Because if I think maybe I didn't get myself sober, but I'm keeping myself sober. How are you doing that? Well, I'm going to a lot of meetings. No kidding. Yeah. Didn't you tell me that you had placed yourself beyond human aid? Well, yeah. Didn't you tell me that no human power could relieve your alcohol? Well, yeah. And now you're suggesting that if you get with other human beings, you're cool? Well, that's not quite what I mean. There's some sort of a little thing that happens if we all get together. No kidding. What would that be? Well, I don't know, but we just sort of get some little, we invoke some power. What power? God's power. Oh, God. Oh, that. I mean, it doesn't hang together, this assumption that I got myself sober, that I'm keeping myself sober. If I think I did that, then I got a little tiny God. A little tiny guy. And that's a problem because when I get to step 7 and say, would you remove my character defects? He's too small to do that. I always had a little tiny God. He was, or a God that was big and distant and way out there and mad. I was with Father, some guy down in Los Angeles, a priest, a sweet guy, a wonderful guy, a priest. I'll think of his name in a minute. He gave a talk. A guy came up to him after the talk. We were in Reno. He came up to him. Cowboy came up to him and said, I'm so glad to hear. I drove clear across the state of Nevada to be here today to hear you speak. And this priest said, well, great, I'm glad you're here. He said, how was your trip? He said, it was amazing. He said, really, what happened? He said, God came with me. He said, no kidding. He said, yeah, he got in the pickup truck right around Elko someplace, drove on in with me. And my friend, the priest, said, did you learn anything about God? He said, yeah, I did. He's real smart. And I'm kind of laughing a little bit when he said that. And then he said, what else you learn? The guy said, this cowboy. He said, he's not pissed off. I went, oh my God. He's not mad at us. Isn't that amazing? It's not part of the deal that he's mad at us. And that's important to notice that. Because all we did was ask. All we did was ask. I don't know what prayer I said. Some guys remember the prayer they said. Take this away from me. I can't stop drinking it. Help me. A gal I heard when I was pretty new in AA talked about the alcoholic's prayer. She said she came out of a blackout in her apartment in Hollywood one night. Came out of it and she was sitting on the mantel over the fireplace with her cat. And there was a little cat food and vodka up there, a little something for everybody. And I'm listening to this woman, and it's like she's pretty and dramatic, and I like her because she just looks cynical, and I'm new in AA, and I'm going to take her to dinner, and as soon as I get a car, Gail, I'm going to take you to dinner. I get my driver's license back, boy. She said the reason that they were up there on that mantle was because there was 4 inches of water on the floor. And then she said that she had started to take a bath last Tuesday and the whole deal got away from her. And that's why there was water on the floor. And I'm going, yeah, I love you, Gail. You're a pig boy just like me. And then she said her alcoholic's prayer, the prayer she said that night, the prayer she never drank after, Jesus Christ, what's wrong with me? That prayer. That prayer. Those guys in World War II, some documents came loose not long ago, Freedom of Information Act stuff. And a guy that knows he's going to die on a battlefield wrote a note, a prayer. He wrote it this way. I couldn't say this prayer, but he wrote it this way, and I get the prayer. God, he wrote, God, come. Come now. Come yourself. Do not send your son. This is no place for children. And I thought, I'm glad they got that prayer. There's a piece of verse next to a photo, a painting in a 12-step house in Tucson, a recovery center. In the foyer is a painting of a drunk guy sitting on the curb, he's lost one shoe, his bottle's half empty, his eyes are empty, he's a mess. And somebody put some verse up beside it. I mean, you can tell by looking at that guy in the painting, he is one of us. He's a real alcoholic. And the verse was interesting. It said, not really, but somebody just put that verse up there. It said, it's true, I'm a drunk. And my soul lives in the shadow of my emotions. And yet there have been songs for me, and my life has had its meaning. But the hand that made me and all I have ever been has deserted me. Would anyone ever know that my life, with all its ruined hours, has been a search for him? And that's my life. I've been searching all my life for him. I didn't know that. Scott Peck says that for us, booze is cheap grace. Cheap grace. It takes us where we want to be for a bit. And we long to go back there. And when we get to the point in this program where we have done the first 10 steps, He gives us some remarkable instructions about step 11. He is, Wilson does. He talks to us about how we go through a day. And it's a fascinating thing to think about. On page 86, I'm not going to say it in the same sequence that he says it, because he starts out when we retire at night. And it is a little out of order for my mind. I want to go to when we wake up. He says on page 86, on awakening, let us think about the 24 hours ahead. We consider our plans for the day, probably plans for what we should be and not do. Before we begin, we ask God to direct our thinking. So the very first thing I have to do in the morning, if I'm going to follow this, is to say, Dear God, direct my thinking today. Direct my thinking. Asking that I be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, or self-seeking motives. And then I consider my plans for the day. First thing I do, direct my thinking. I don't even have my feet on the floor. Direct my thinking. Please direct my thinking. And it's because I think it's like this. I think we have two types of intellect available to us. We have intellect, and we have intellect with power. And when it's just my intellect, I'm living my life from my ego. My ego is running it. My ego, which drives me with fear, wants to keep me in familiar territory. My ego that says, don't do that. Don't ask her out. Don't take that job. Don't even apply for that job. Don't go out there. And don't turn your will and your life over to the care. Are you kidding? He'll have you passing out tracts on the streets of Billings. Don't do that. You just let me control your life. I'll give you all you need. Ego's job is to keep us safe. And I live my life from a relationship with my ego for all my life. And that kind of an intellect is a frightening thing, because it gives me a day that looks like this. If I'm over here on the left side of the page and I'm living my life from my ego, the thing that I have going for me is fear and discontent. Or as Silkworth said, restlessness, irritability, and discontent. Which I always thought, yeah, on my best days, I'm restless. Can you imagine, here he is looking at those new drunks in Towns Hospital. He's been around AA for a while. Now he can write about them. And he can talk about these guys coming in, sitting at his desk. How are you feeling today, Joe? Joe's just that moment decided to move to New Zealand. So he says, oh, a little restless. Always that understatement. We don't want him to know. But if I'm living my life from my ego, from that thing, what do I have? I have scarcity. There's never enough time. There's never enough love. There's not enough money. We know that. There's just not. It's scarcity. I want to be right. The whole point of my life is to be right. My ego doesn't care if I'm happy, but I got to be right. I got to be right. I want to win. I have a lot of pride. I'm defensive. I'm always reacting. I react. You get a toad in the road and you poke it with a stick and you get a reaction. I react. That's all I can do. I feel guilty. I'm a good guilt thrower and catcher. I'm full of blame. Happiness is knowing who to blame. We know that. My perceptions are out. My question in my life is, what's in it for me? I need control. Boy, you find yourself imposing control on everything around you, or trying to. Doesn't she respond nicely when we're into that? Ooh. They're so receptive later on in bed. Oh. All I was doing was helping her. Think clearly. Shame. Forgiveness? No. Conditional forgiveness, you bet. I'll forgive you. I'll never forget it, but I'll forgive you. That isn't forgiveness, but that's what we're... Conditional love. I mean, what dress does she have to put on for me to really have my ego calm down? And that's just the tip of that iceberg. And that's how it goes. I mean, this is my day. This is my day. I'm living my life from my ego. I get out on that freeway in Los Angeles. Somebody cuts me off. It's just like, that is so personal. I laughed a couple of months ago. A gal pulled in front of me on the freeway and her bumper sticker said, "Relax, it's only a lane change." I thought, you bitch. No, I didn't. Page 37 in the book, it says, "My mind lacks proportion and can't think straight." I mean, since when did it get to be a capital offense to pull into the same lane I'm in? My lane. And we know it is my lane. Some years ago, I was dating a gal, and I called her from San Francisco, and the conversation got a little tense. I was helping her, and she hung up. And I wanted to kill her. I really wanted to kill her. There's a mind that lacks proportion and can't think straight. That's not a good defense to a charge of murder. Well, she hung up, Your Honor. What do you expect? And we do that. We're just there. We're there. Why would I say direct my thinking? Because I have another type of intellect available to me, and it's called intellect with power, or I call it intellect with power. If I'm coming from a relationship with God, which Wilson says is the solution in a cleverly entitled chapter called "There Is a Solution," then we're coming from love and we're coming from trust. And that's a very different thing. That's a very different thing. Instead of coming from scarcity, I'm coming from abundance. I would turn this a little bit, but I'm going to turn it anyway. I'm so sorry I did that. I'm coming from abundance. In other words, there's plenty of time. There's plenty of love. There's plenty of money. Love is infinite. Well, she can't love her girlfriend and love me too. Really? Where did that come from? Scarcity. Well, what if she loves her mother more than me? No kidding. Scarcity, that's all. Thank you. I'd like it to be said that Doug has chipped in here. Recorded, does he have come from a good line of sponsorship? Thank you, Doug. Yeah. But he's coming from love now. Do you get that? I don't. If I'm coming from my ego, I want to be right. If I'm coming from a relationship with God, I'm much more interested in being happy. But you know, I'd rather be right than happy too many days. Does that resonate? I want to win. No. Surrender. What's the difference? What have you got to win? I want pride. No. Humility. Defensive? No. Don't defend yourself. If I'm coming from love, if I'm coming from relationship with God, there's nothing to defend. Instead of reacting, I'm at choice. I have choice. I can let it go. I can do any number of things. But I don't have to react. You son of a... No. That's a reaction. Choice is, I can see why he said that. I can see why he did that. I'm coming instead of guilt, appreciation, not blame, but responsibility, not perception, but intuitive thought. I have these perceptions, and I project the past out in the future, and I call that reality. Frightening way to live. In other words, my ego says, when I was about 4 years old, I decided, maybe five, I decided I couldn't trust my mother. Decided she didn't love me. And that followed me all my life. It's called an old idea. You can't trust the important women in your life. And until I went back through the process of these steps, I was stuck with that thing. And every woman I brought into my life was a woman that I eventually learned was out to get me. Was it true in reality? No. Did I run off a lot of good women thinking they were out to get me? Yes. Oh, she's wearing that red sweater today. She must be out to get me. I mean, it has no sense. And we're going to be talking about this as we go through the weekend. But this is step 11 and why it's important that we say direct my thinking. And you can go all the way down that list. I don't need control. I just want to be part of the group, unity. I don't need to get involved in shame. There's acceptance. Forgiveness becomes real forgiveness, and we'll talk about that Sunday morning. Love becomes unconditional. There is in this book an amazing thing. One of the prefaces, it talks about the origin of anonymity. I should say the foreword to the first, the preface on Romans 11 says this. On Romans 13, the forward to the first edition. It's important that we remain anonymous because we're too few at present to handle the overwhelming number of personal appeals which may result from this book. Do you hear the fear in that? They're saying, basically, we'd love to tell you who we are, but we're going to have you write World Publishing because if you knew where we were, we couldn't get out our door to go to work. And we want you to know this is an avocation. That was written in 1939. In 1939, this chip of a book was cast out there, and the foreword to the first edition said, we can't tell you who we are because we are too few at present to meet the overwhelming demand that is sure to follow. They're coming from scarcity. They're coming from fear. An amazing thing happened. Within about 7 years, the traditions were written. In 1946, the traditions were written. In 1946, Wilson started selling the rest of the membership on the fact we need the traditions. In 1951, they were presented to the Congress at Cleveland, that convention, and in 1951 they were ratified by the members of AA, but they were written in 46, 7 years after 1939, when he said anonymity has got to be it, because we're, and listen to what he says in just 7 short years. He says, finally, we of Alcoholics Anonymous believe that the principle of anonymity has an immense spiritual significance. It reminds us that we're to place principles before personalities, that we are actually to practice a genuine humility. This to the end that our great blessings may never spoil us, that we shall forever live in a thankful contemplation of Him who presides over us all. I'm talking about something that I wondered all my, when I would hear that, I'd say, how is it that anonymity has such immense spiritual significance? And then along the way, I had an opportunity to raise a 5-year-old boy. His mother and I got together. I didn't want a kid in my life. I didn't want any of that. It's like the universe hands you an envelope and you look and there's a lady and there's a 5-year-old kid. And I had started going through these steps again. And I said, yes, I'll do that. And they were in my life for about 5 years. And during the course of that 5 years, this young man went from age four to age nine. During the course of that 5 years, this kid and I fell in love with each other. I'm not a good parent. I don't want to be a parent. I don't want any trouble. I don't want any of these. And I don't want to raise this kid. And he's suddenly in my life. One day I'll look at this kid 2 years have gone by. I mean, I've been kneeling down with him at his bed at night praying and listening to him say things that knock me out, like, thank you, God, that I'm at the top of the food chain. You go, yes, we like what this kid is. I mean, they're just wonderful. I'd fall over laughing. One time, I'm a little off track here, but we flew up to Oakland. He and I, his mom was over someplace talking. And then we got in a rental car because I had to give a talk up. And we're in the car, and I say, Daniel, man, I love traveling with you. And he said, thank you. I said, no, I mean it. We were sitting there in the plane, and this kid came across from the other side of the airplane, and he wanted you to go in the back with him to do something. And I'm glad you didn't go back there. Daniel said, well, I didn't really know him that well. I said, well, you know what? He said he wanted to play, but I think he wanted to go back there and get in trouble. Daniel looked at me and he said, we don't know that about him. I went, shut up, kid. You've been talking to me. God, he taught me something every day, you know. But the thing that was so remarkable about it was that one day I got that he loved me. And he was just loving me. Nothing on it. Totally clean, just loving me. And I was in this process of the steps then, and so I had a thought right behind it. And the thought was, my mom always told me that God is love and that God works through people. Wouldn't it be hot if God's loving me through this boy? Because he doesn't object to it. There's no obstacle there. And I knew in that moment that God was loving me through that little boy. And within a few weeks, I got it, that God's loving that boy through me. Through me. Now, that's unconditional love. My deal with Linda isn't about trying to give her unconditional love. My deal is, if I can live my life in such a way that God can love her through me, I have a different thing. But that requires letting go of all the stuff I want from her. Whether it's approval. You know, we're addicted to a drug called approval. And then we marry our dealer and the fight is on. But it's a different life. It's like when we're on a 12-step call, you know. Man, we are just showing up. But somehow that guy gets loved. I may be mad at him. I may be annoyed. I may be tired. This and that. Or I bring a guy to the meeting or sit next to a guy. And somehow or other, because I'm talking to him, there is an unconditional love coming through me that I may be aware of and I may not be. But it's a different deal. So, step 11. Before we begin, we ask God to direct our thinking. Because I want to be coming from a relationship with God. I want to take abundance and happiness and surrender and humility and defenselessness and choice and appreciation into my day. That's what I want to take into the day. Because if I can start down that track, I'm going to have a sweeter day than if I take all this other stuff, scarcity and wanting to be right and winning and pride and defensiveness and reaction. And I'm a trial lawyer. And I'm in court a lot. And I'm here to tell you that you can live this way. But I have to ask God, direct my thinking. Direct my thinking. And then during the day, the second phase of this, he takes us through the meditation thing. And the meditation, he says something remarkable. He says, it would be easy to be vague about this, but we feel we have some specific and valuable suggestions to make. It would be easy to be vague about this matter, yet we believe we can make some definite and valuable suggestions. He says, we may not be able to determine which course to take. Here we ask God for inspiration and intuitive thought or a decision. We relax and take it easy. That's not my ego. Relax and take it easy? No, no. I've got to think a while. I've got to use this mind of mine and think about it. We don't struggle. We usually conclude the period of meditation with a prayer. And then he says, as we go through, so this would be a second stage, as we go through the day, we pause when agitated or doubtful and ask for the right thought or action. So I drew a little line, dotted line down there between the two kinds of intellect. I call it the agitation and doubt line. Because I'll start out over here, I'm over there. She pulls in front of me, over there, in my lane, trying to ruin my career. Doesn't take me long to get there. I hear that tone, whatever it is. This is an agitation and doubt line, and I cross that line going 100 miles an hour. And Wilson says, at that point, we have to pause and ask for the right thought or action. I can be in one kind of thinking or the other. They don't blend. I'll move back and forth. There's no blending of this. I'm either coming down one line or I'm coming down the other line. I've discovered for myself that maybe two times in these years I've been able to pause when agitated or doubtful and ask for the right thought or action. I just go over there and I'm in this middle of it. But I've discovered something quite wonderful, and that is this. If I pause and go inside and ask for just a connection before I get over here, I don't go over there. I mean, it's like I start out and then I get into the office and then something will trigger me and I'll ask in the morning. I'll ask. In my prayers, I'll say, remind me to pause before I'm agitated or doubtful. And I can say, keep me on track. Give me the right thought and action. And then back out, not a long thing, a couple of seconds. And that gets to be my prayer. I want to be useful. I want to have the pause so I can come in and ask for help. And I want you to direct my thinking.